Well, thank you to those of you who are here with us live. And my apologies again for holding this class on Wednesday instead of Thursday. But of course, all the materials are archived, as is usually the case, so you can have access to them whenever you need them. Our topic for today is part two of organizational design, where we'll discuss specifically issues related to compensation and motivation. So providing incentives for employees and for executives, evaluating performance, how we come up with compensation schemes that work right for people at all levels of the organization. And if we have time, a little bit about problems facing managers of nonprofit firms or non-market firms, even government agencies, in designing compensation schemes in cases where output is not easily measured. Before we start, I want to mention, as we discussed previously in the lecture and in the instructions, that we will have a short final exam available for those of you who would like to get credit for the course. And the exam will be finalized in the next few days and deployed either over the weekend or more likely the first of the week, probably Monday of next week. And you'll have a finite window of approximately 7 days in which you can take the exam. There will be some multiple choice questions, some short answer questions, and maybe a few longer analytical problems. Again, it's not a requirement for anyone to take the exam, but if you do take it and get a satisfactory score, a passing score, then you'll be able to get a formal certificate indicating your participation and successful completion of the course. And I'll be happy to answer questions about the structure of the examination and the types of questions on the discussion forums in the next few days. So again, if you think back to what we've covered so far, we started off with the basics of what management is and how economic analysis, Austrian analysis in particular, might apply to managerial problems. We talked a little bit about demand. We talked about production, cost, and entrepreneurship. We discussed firm strategy and how an Austrian understanding of markets and entrepreneurship might help a firm achieve some kind of advantage over its rivals. And then in our last meeting, we talked about firm boundaries and organizational design. Today, we're going to talk about another aspect of organizational design, a very important one, namely, how do we motivate or incentivize people in an organization to do what we want them to do? Now, in discussing compensation and motivation and the need for firms to have a compensation policy, we're not assuming that that workers are somehow lazy or shiftless or will not necessarily do what they're supposed to do. We're not taking any normative position whatsoever on the characteristics of individuals in a firm or individuals that you might trade with outside a firm. We're simply saying that if we want to get behavior coordinated, if we want everyone to be working together for the common goal of improving the performance of the firm, it may be the case that some people are also pursuing other goals, right? A worker may be very well-intentioned. A manager may have the best interests of the company at heart, but he or she faces potential conflicts. You have personal issues, family issues. Maybe you disagree with the senior executives about a course of action that should be taken. And so if we want to somehow smooth out these differences and get everyone sort of pulling together in the same direction, we need to have some design of our compensation system. We need to think seriously about how we motivate and incentivize people to do what we want them to do. Now, I want to start our discussion of compensation with a little bit of maybe what we might call a counterfactual analysis, or before we talk about details of compensation policy within organizations, let's just review kind of a basic Econ 101 sort of analysis of how labor markets work. Now, remember, we discussed earlier in the course how firms are means of producing goods and services by transforming inputs or factors of production into useful outputs. And we talked about the concept of the marginal productivity of a factor, right? How much does one unit of labor or one unit of electricity or one more unit of some raw material contribute to the final output? And if we put this in monetary terms, well, we might ask, how much does one additional unit of input contribute to the additional revenue the firm can earn from selling the product that is produced by that additional unit of an input? And we went over the concept of a marginal product, a marginal revenue product, and since production takes time, the discounted marginal revenue product. And we went through the standard Austrian analysis, so-called marginal productivity theory, explaining how the payment to a given factor of production tends to be determined by its discounted marginal revenue product. In other words, if I am an employee of an organization, say the University of Missouri, where I am in fact employed, the amount I will get paid by the university will tend to equal the additional revenues received by the university in exchange for my additional labor input. Remember, the university is not producing outputs, educational services and other things, based on my input alone, but the way in which my input is combined with the inputs of other factors of production, other workers, other managers, raw materials, the services of capital goods, and so on. And in our discussion of entrepreneurship and profit and loss, remember we said that in equilibrium, if all factors are paid exactly equal to their discounted marginal revenue products, then the entrepreneur may receive an interest return as a reward for paying the workers in advance of production, but there will be no residual profit or loss because all of the income that is received in revenues will be paid out to the factors of production according to their discounted marginal contribution to output. And we said that profit and loss results from a disequilibrium. In other words, the fact that when factors of production are paid, the exact receipts to those factors, to the use of those factors, are in the future and hence unknown. So entrepreneurs will earn profit and loss according to their ability to anticipate how much a factor will actually be paid. But imagine that there's competition among entrepreneurs and a tendency for these profits and losses to be squeezed out. So imagine a kind of equilibrium condition in which resources, factors of production, are in fact being paid their discounted marginal revenue products. Right? In a case like that, we would say, well, if we're looking at a labor market, in other words, a pool of workers with broadly similar characteristics, a group of economics professors, or a group of fast food workers, or a group of professional basketball players, or whatever, we would say that for each type of labor, within each category of labor, the wage in that market will tend to equal the discounted marginal revenue product of labor. And, you know, if you've ever studied labor economics before, you've probably seen a diagram something like the one I have on the screen here. Right, think of this as just sort of a heuristic device for explaining how in the market for fast food workers, right, the wages paid to fast food workers will tend to equal the marginal revenue product or discounted marginal revenue product if we take time into consideration, depending on how much labor is used. Right, so this marginal revenue product curve, you can think of that from the employer's point of view as a kind of demand curve for labor, right? And if the wage is equal to this level represented by the horizontal line on the diagram, at that wage, the number of people employed in the market can simply be read off that downward marginal revenue product of labor curve or schedule, right? So at the wage given in the by the horizontal line here, the number of persons employed will be roughly E star employees. Again, this is employees that are who are roughly homogeneous in a given market where, you know, employers don't really care which employee they get as long as they get someone who is able to, you know, perform the basic tasks. We could add a supply curve of labor if we wanted to discuss people's willingness to enter the labor force for a given wage. And we would actually be able to do some fairly useful things with this sort of benchmark standard model of wages. I mean, if we want to know why are economics professors generally paid more than fast food workers, we'd say, well, the marginal productivity, the discounted marginal productivity of these highly trained, charismatic, and in some cases very handsome professionals is substantially higher than the discounted marginal revenue product of somebody who flips hamburgers. Likewise, if you want to know why professional basketball players, LeBron James and Kevin Durant and so on, tend to make quite a bit more money than economics professors, we would say the amount they contribute to the revenues received by the NBA and the company that makes the shoes they endorse and the television contracts and so forth, that they're getting paid roughly an amount equal to their marginal contribution to output. This is a perfectly reasonable way to think about labor markets when we're interested in these kinds of broad questions. Why do some types of workers get paid more than others? Or if we want to analyze an important policy issue like the effective minimum wage laws. Those of you in the U.S. know that this is a hot topic. The president has proposed increasing the federal minimum wage to something like $10.15 an hour, which is substantially higher than what low-wage workers get paid in many occupations. And when you hear economists say, well, increasing the minimum wage might mean more money in the pockets of some workers, those workers who continue to be employed at that higher minimum wage, it will also displace a number of workers from the labor market. It will also lead to an increase in unemployment. I mean, you can look at the diagram here, right? If the government forces the wage to be higher than the wage that's determined in the market, that means we're moving up this marginal revenue product curve, right? We're going towards the northwest direction. The number of employees who are hired at that higher minimum wage is going to be lower than it is at the market wage. So analyzing minimum wage laws, thinking about why different types of workers are paid different amounts, a very simple model in which we explain wages according to discounted marginal revenue products can be very useful. Of course, even in this context, entrepreneurs will make errors, right? Some workers will be paid more than their discounted marginal revenue product, which means a loss for the employer. Some workers will be paid less, which means profit for the employer. But on average, we can gain a lot of insight into wage profiles by thinking about marginal revenue product. Now, that is all well and good, but this kind of analysis, the simple benchmark model of the labor market, has a number of drawbacks as well. Think of the sort of oversimplifications that go into that kind of analysis. First, this simple model assumes that as Rothbard would put it, all labor inputs are isolable, meaning that we can isolate the marginal contribution of one input from the marginal contributions of the other inputs that go into producing it. Again, in some cases, that may be perfectly reasonable. The professor teaches a course in managerial economics, and the university gets some additional revenue from the teaching of that course, but the professor teaching that course doesn't have any effect on how much the university makes from teaching other courses, or licensing its logo to put on T-shirts, or whatever. But there may be other cases, a symphony orchestra, for example, where the marginal product of the first violin player cannot really be isolated from the marginal product of a tuba player, right? Because you need both playing at the same time in perfect harmony for the concert promoter to be able to sell any tickets whatsoever. So if labor inputs are not isolable, if there's some team synergies, some inability to separate, or inseparability, as they call it, in team production, then it may be that the employer, the entrepreneur, can assign a discounted marginal revenue product to the team, to the orchestra, for example, but not to individual members of the team, not to individual musicians. So we would then need some additional theory to explain how much the violin player gets paid as opposed to how much the tuba player gets paid. Another assumption of the standard sort of benchmark model is that all compensation is monetary. In other words, the only return that I as a worker care about is cash in my pocket. However, as we know, and we'll discuss in detail in just a moment, there may be other aspects of compensation too, right? There might be fringe benefits. There might be intangible rewards. There might be the promise of future compensation if I do certain things in the present. And in deciding where I want to work and how much I'm willing to work in exchange for the wage that's offered, I'm thinking not just of the cash that goes into my pocket right now, but the total compensation package, which might include a lot of other things that are difficult to put into a simple diagram like that. The benchmark model also assumes that labor contracts are sort of spot contracts. You know, the worker is hired to perform this task one time, and then he goes home and that's it. It's almost as if all labor markets were like the market for, you know, day labor at a farm. So think about, you know, a farm in Southern California or Texas where there are a lot of migrant workers from Mexico, maybe undocumented workers from Mexico. And, you know, the foreman shows up at a certain street corner in the morning, and the farm manager, there's a street corner and all these guys are hanging out. And the farm manager says, okay, I need five guys today. And five guys hop into the truck and off they go. And they work in the field for a day and they get paid in cash and sent home. And that's it. The employer doesn't even learn their names, much less have any kind of ongoing relationship with these workers. You know, again, that's like the market for the consumer buying tomatoes or buying tennis shoes, maybe renting cars. I mean, there are all kinds of markets that operate in this sort of highly anonymous spot market fashion. But of course, many other markets don't, right? A lot of inputs are procured through long-term contracts, excuse me, or even vertical integration, as we saw the other day. And of course, the same is true for many kinds of labor, especially in the managerial and professional fields, right? You might have a one-year agreement or a five-year agreement or an implicit lifetime agreement with an employer. And when I think about my willingness to work for that employer or what I'll do with that employer, I'm thinking about my compensation over the term of the contract, not just the compensation, you know, moment by moment. And finally, the simple benchmark model assumes that, you know, within a given market, the market for fast food workers or the market for economics professors, or the market for professional basketball players, workers are relatively homogeneous, right? There are no important differences in ability coming from differences in knowledge or experience or motivation. But it may be that thinking of, you know, the market for hamburger flippers or the market for economics professors, maybe that's too broad, that's too high a level of aggregation. Maybe each fast food worker or each professor, or each NBA player is unique. And we can't really aggregate them into a market and talk about sort of market supply and demand. Well, what I want to do in the next few minutes is sort of go through these assumptions of the basic benchmark model one by one and say, well, what insight can we generate into compensation practice? What knowledge can we learn from relaxing these assumptions, from assuming that there are long-term contracts and there are non-monetary forms of compensation? There are differences among workers, and sort of see what we can learn. Okay? So let's start by thinking about the assumption that all compensation is monetary. Well, obviously that is not true for many kinds of jobs, right? For many kinds of jobs, there's some kind of, you know, cash payment, a wage or a salary, but there are also fringe benefits, a pension plan, you know, a free parking space, maybe a company car, perhaps daycare services for children, a certain number of vacation days, and so forth. Right? These are all aspects of the compensation package that have to be negotiated by employer and employee. And so if we're only looking at the wage, and we say the wage is so many dollars per hour or so many dollars per week or month, that doesn't give us a very accurate picture of the total compensation package. In other words, two jobs might, you know, pay exactly the same wage, but have very different working conditions, very different levels of fringe benefits, and in fact, those would be two different compensation levels, even if the wage appears to be the same. You know, there are also sort of intangible benefits like the quality of the work environment, the satisfaction one gets from performing the job that may compensate for a lower cash payment, right? Look at my pictures here. I mean, look at the guy on the right. This is sort of the typical nerdy professor. He looks like a nerdy professor, doesn't he? Now, if you ask a lot of professors, especially those who teach who are in economics or management or business or entrepreneurship, you know, they would all say, and I would certainly say, that, you know, if I weren't teaching, if I weren't engaged in scholarly pursuits, I would be a Fortune 500 CEO, no doubt about it, because of my abilities, and I would be paid millions and millions of dollars per year. But I have willingly given all that up just for the sheer enjoyment of, you know, sitting in a cramped office with a lot of books and reading books. No, seriously, you know, a lot of people who teach or, you know, are researchers or whatever, they just enjoy it, right? They think it's a lot of fun, and they willingly accept, you know, less pay than they would get if they were investment bankers because they enjoy the work that they do. Or, you know, a park ranger, right? Maybe you just enjoy being in the great outdoors and being on your feet all day and not being stuck behind a desk wearing a tie, and so you accept a lower wage than you would if you had to work, you know, a desk job. There's an interesting aspect of this for entrepreneurs as well. One of the things that research on entrepreneurial compensation has revealed, and this surprises some people, that self-employed individuals on average earn less money than people with similar characteristics who are employed by, you know, existing companies. So, you know, if you get into entrepreneurship in the sense of self-employment because you think that's the best way to get rich, on average, you're probably going to be frustrated, right? And of course, you know, at the tail end of the distribution, there are, you know, the Bill Gateses and the Steve Jobses and so forth who are millionaires many times over. But on average, self-employed people earn less than employed people. Now, some interpret this result by saying, well, people who become self-employed are just crazy, right? Or they're over-optimistic, they're naive, they have no idea how hard it is, they have no idea how little money they'll make. But another interpretation is that self-employed people value being self-employed. They value autonomy. I'm willing to accept a lower amount of cash in exchange for the satisfaction of being my own boss, building my own company, and so forth. Right? So the autonomy one gets from self-employment can be considered part of the compensation package. Right? So that on average, the self-employed person, you know, gets the same amount in terms of money and intangible benefits as how much, you know, that same person would be paid in money without the intangible benefits if he were working for another firm. We can gain some insight into particular business practices, right, by thinking about these potential trade-offs between monetary and non-monetary compensation. For example, suppose that you're a manager and you preferred workers with different family situation. You might prefer married workers over single workers because you think that married workers on average are more mature and they're more disciplined. The sort of experiences that they have dealing with their household may actually improve their ability as workers or as managers. Or alternatively, you know, maybe you prefer, for the kind of work that you're doing, you prefer single people, right? You prefer unattached workers because then, you know, they're less likely to have to call in sick to take care of stay home to take care of a sick kid, or they're less distracted at work. You can get them to work on nights and weekends because they don't have a family, whatever. I mean, there might be any number of reasons why you might prefer to hire a worker of one type or another. But of course, in most countries, discriminating on the basis of marital status would be a violation of employment law. And so you can't actually do that. You can't ask them if they're, you can't ask a prospective job applicant. You can't ask a job applicant if they're married or not. You can't ask how many kids they have because you might be subject to a discrimination lawsuit. But there are other things that you could do, right? If you wanted to hire married workers with kids, you could simply offer a compensation package that is lower than what your competitors offer in terms of cash compensation, in terms of the monetary part of the package, but you offer very generous sick leave, maternity leave, you offer a generous insurance, health insurance program that covers family members, you offer a generous life insurance program, you offer, you know, frequent days off for dealing with you know, family situations or whatever. If you only wanted to hire single people, maybe you would offer a package that pays well, but doesn't offer, you know, benefits for spouses or something like that, doesn't offer many sick days and so forth. In other words, you might be able to attract the kind of worker you want by offering a particular mix of salary and benefits. Of course, this would be legal, right? You're simply offering a specific package and inviting people to self-select according to their own characteristics. That, of course, would not be illegal, and it would be a way of getting the kinds of workers that you want. Something else for thinking about government policy, right? Government policies in labor markets are often pretty naive in this regard, right? So again, the minimum wage is a floor on the monetary part of the compensation. And you might think, oh, but, you know, for minimum wage jobs like fast food jobs, I mean, there's not really a whole lot of fringe benefits. But there are non-monetary aspects of the compensation package. And they might be modest, but not insignificant. How many breaks you get, whether you get a free meal during the shift, whether you have to buy your own uniform and funny hat, or whether they provide you with the uniform or the funny hat. So there have been some empirical studies of minimum wage laws claiming to show that the displacement effect, the employment effect, is smaller than sort of standard economic theories would have anticipated. And some proponents of the minimum wage have said, oh, well, that just shows that employers don't react to an increase in the minimum wage by laying off workers. You know, standard economic theory is wrong, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, what sometimes happens in cases like that is if the law requires the employer to pay more in cash, they might simply cut back on some of the other elements of the package. You know, okay, no more free hamburger during your lunch break. You got to buy your own meal. We no longer provide the uniform. You have to buy your own uniform. You get fewer breaks, work less favorable shifts or whatever. These may be ways, you know, in a case like that, the total cash outlay from the employer's point of view may not really change very much. It just shifts from more of it goes into the wage component and less goes into the provision of these ancillary benefits. We might also look at the tax treatment of fringe benefits, right? In most countries, employment earnings are taxed, but the cash value of fringe benefits go untaxed, right? That's why in the U.S., most people get their health insurance through their employer. That's because they don't pay tax on the value of that of the benefit package. So in a tax environment like that, there will be a tendency for firms to pay more in benefits rather than cash, which is, you know, not in the interest of all workers, right? Some workers might not want such a large benefit package. They might prefer to get more of their compensation in cash and less in health insurance or you know, the pension plan or whatever, but the government policy does not allow them to get that because of the tax code. Here's another example of a non-monetary benefit that people might not think of. You know, the quality of your office. This is an interesting example of managerial architecture. This is some of you may recognize the building. This is the Bank of America building in downtown San Francisco, and I always thought it was neat when I looked at this building because of the the way they designed it with corners, right? It's like if you looked at the building from the top down, it's sort of corrugated in shape. What's nice about this? Well, you know, everybody wants to get promoted to having the corner office. There's prestige and status associated with inhabiting a corner office. Well, if you work in this building, every office is a corner office, right? So one would think that firms that have that are located in this particular building could pay lower wages than competing firms in other buildings because everybody here gets a corner office, and maybe that compensates you for a lower wage. Maybe not. Okay. Remember that non-monetary aspects of the job can not only be good, but they can be bad as well, right? What labor economists call a compensating differential, right? That's the additional wage or salary you have to pay somebody to get them to be willing to take a job that is less desirable, right? Like collecting trash, right? So if you think about being a trash collector, I mean, you know, what do you actually do on the job? Well, you ride around on the back of a truck, and you, you pick up trash bags and you dump them in the back of the truck. So, you know, physically, that's not too different from loading a truck. I mean, you bend down and pick up heavy stuff and you put it in the truck. But garbage workers get paid more on average than movers who are hired to load a truck. Why? Because it stinks. Right, people don't want to be around trash all the time, and so you have to pay them a little bit extra to attract them to that particular kind of work. People who work the night shift often get paid more than people who work the day shift for the same job because other things equal, most people prefer to work during the day rather than working at night. And you know, there may be some work environments that are particularly dangerous or simply unpleasant, like the health workers shown in this photo, and they get, to attract anyone to that job, you have to pay them a little bit more. One other example from the San Francisco Bay Area, check out this guy. What is his job? Well, I guess we would classify his job as a painter, right? This guy is painting. That's what he does for a living. But I would suspect that the workers who do this particular type of painting get paid more per hour than your typical house painter, right? Because you're painting, and at the same time, risking that you take a wrong step and end up plunging to your death in the middle of the San Francisco Bay. So, again, if we only classified jobs according to the money wage, we would have a hard time explaining why this guy gets a little bit more money than a house painter. But once we recognize that you're getting that pay has multiple elements and is compensation for all of the aspects of the work program, then we can certainly understand why some people get paid more than others for doing what might on the surface look like the same work. Okay, another one of our assumptions in sort of the standard analysis is that, buying a unit of labor is no different from buying a newspaper at a corner stand or buying a piece of fruit or whatever, when in fact many firms tend to establish longer term kind of ongoing relationships with employees. Well, what does that sort of add to our analysis? Again, think about what is sometimes called an internal labor market. Right, so many firms will fill their entry-level positions from the outside, hiring fresh college graduates or younger workers, less experienced workers. But then for their upper-level positions, they'll tend to promote from within, Right? So you could, so in other words, an internal labor market is where you're reallocating labor among different positions or different levels from the inside, rather than filling all new positions with workers from the outside. Again, this sort of long-term relationship could be formal. I mean, it could be written in the contract that, you know, absent conditions A, B, and C, you will be employed for a period of 6 months or 1 year or 2 years, and you'll be paid you know, according to a certain formula. But, you know, it could also be informal, right? You might be employed in a situation where legally, I mean, you could quit any day or you could be fired any day, but based on experience, based on reputation, there's sort of an informal understanding that, you know, you won't be fired unless you fail to meet certain performance targets, and the employer understands that you won't quit unless, you know, there's certain conditions in the work environment that make it unsatisfactory or whatever. I mean, you know, you look at the countries like Japan, you know, where we had sort of the, for many years there was the custom of, you know, very little mobility within, mobility of workers between firms, for especially for, you know, white collar kinds of positions. You would tend to stay with the firm for your entire career. And in the U.S. and Europe, in generations past, you know, maybe your grandfather worked for one company his entire career, and then he retired at age 65, and they gave him a gold watch and so forth. You know, that's very different from the typical labor market today that we find, especially in, you know, the technology sector, where people just sort of hop between jobs with a very high frequency. So, you know, is it a good idea for firms to use internal labor markets? Is it a good idea for firms to offer explicitly or implicitly a long-term contract with the worker? Well, I think like anything else, right, long-term labor agreements have benefits and costs. There are some advantages and there are some disadvantages. For example, this may... offering a long-term contract may give an incentive for workers to invest in firm-specific knowledge, routines, capabilities, and so forth. Right? If I'm hired by the University of Missouri and I think I might get fired any day, well, I'm not going to put a lot of time into developing, you know, courses that are, you know, just right for these students. Right, I'm not going to find out what other courses are offered within the major and try to coordinate my courses with the major. I'm not going to bother to learn about, you know, what resources the university offers for students, because I'm afraid that I wouldn't be able to get any return to that investment. Right, I would only make investments that were completely generic, where, you know, I would get some return on those investments no matter where I worked. If the firm wants me to invest in learning firm-specific routines, then it should give me some assurance, at least implicitly, that I'm going to get some return on that investment by getting to work there for a long time. You know, there may be a motivational aspect too, right? I mean, maybe I feel like I'm more part of a family, you know, I'm a member of the team once I've been here for a long time, and that may make me better motivated, and I may work harder and work smarter and so forth. There's also some advantage to the firm from hiring internal workers, I mean workers that have already worked there for some time, because you may know a lot about their attributes. As some of you may have heard the expression, you know, it's better to go with the devil you know than the devil you don't know. In other words, you know, if we're going to promote somebody to a senior management position, well, the people who have already been in the firm for a while in junior management positions, you know, we know what they're good at and we know what they're not so good at, and we kind of know what we're getting when we hire them. There might be a hotshot potential executive from outside who could be great, but could be a disaster, and maybe we don't want to take that risk, right? At the same time, there are a number of drawbacks, right? There are disadvantages of hiring from inside and offering long-term contracts. I mean, maybe this restricts competition for higher-level jobs, right? I mean, maybe the best person for this promotion is really not somebody you already have, but some outsider that you don't know about yet. You don't want to overlook that potential outsider in looking for filling this position. And, you know, there may be a negative motivational effect. Right? If I feel confident that I won't be fired for a long time, then what incentive do I have to perform well? Just like giving professors at a university tenure, this little demotivating poster. It says tenure, and the subtitle is, I never have to work again, right? I'm guaranteed to get paid whether I do a good job or not. So the point is, right, not that a firm should always offer long-term contracts, nor that a firm should never offer long-term contracts. Rather, that there are pros and cons, and that, you know, you have to sort of weigh these pros and cons in each specific case. Now, here's an interesting aspect of how people are paid when the firm uses internal labor markets, right? Imagine that it's the case that you know, more experienced workers are actually better; they're more productive. They have more knowledge, maybe they have better motivation, so that their productivity for the firm actually increases with the amount of time they've been with the firm. So the discounted marginal revenue product is increasing with the amount of time the worker has spent with the firm. So I've got an upward sloping DMRP curve according to time here in blue, right? So we're not saying that we're not saying that marginal revenue product is increasing with the quantity of labor hired, rather that the DMRP for a given worker may increase with the worker's experience with the firm. But one thing that we often see in many contexts is that firms tend to pay inexperienced workers less than their discounted marginal revenue product, while paying more experienced workers more than their discounted marginal revenue product. So even though DMRP is increasing with service to the firm, the level of compensation may be increasing even more rapidly, right? So the idea is that, you know, entry-level workers get paid less than their DMRP, whereas senior, more experienced workers get paid more than their DMRP. Now, you could set it up where it sort of averages out over time, right? So during the course of my time with the firm, my average amount of pay will be equal to my average marginal productivity, but they don't equal, you know, sort of moment by moment, month by month, year by year. Now, why would you ever want to do that? Well, one possibility is that the firm wants workers to stick around and to try to do the things they need to do in order to get promoted. And one way to do that is by setting up this particular kind of earnings profile, right? If this is sort of transparent to everybody, the entry-level workers who are working really hard, you know, they know that they're being sort of underpaid relative to their actual contribution, and they know that the fat cats who have been working for the firm for a long time are getting overpaid, getting paid more than their marginal productivity. But you think, well, hey, if I work hard, if I do a good job, if I stick with the firm, if I get promoted up the ranks, then eventually I'll get to be a fat cat. And I'll get to reap these rewards of hard work, and I'll get to get the extra pay, right? I'm underpaid now, but I know that it's only a matter of time before I get to be one of the overpaid privileged few. That may be an incentive for me to stick with the firm and to do the things that I'm asked to do to get promoted by the firm, right? Obviously, this is not going to be much of a motivator if the entry-level workers think they're going to be fired at any moment. Right, so the assumption is that the firm is using some kind of explicit or implicit long-term, labor contract. But you can think of the extra compensation that experienced workers get as being a kind of a prize. Right, so if you stick around long enough, you'll get the prize. Now, maybe the prize has some, you know, maybe it's very explicit. There's an explicit moment, again, like a university professor, college professor being awarded tenure, right? Untenured professors work very hard because they know that the reward of tenure is, you know, on the horizon. And if they do certain things, they will get or they might get tenure, and then they can relax and take it easy. Think about a law firm or an accounting firm or any other professional services firm that's organized along a partnership model, right? So, you know, new lawyers are hired in as associates, and they work their tails off doing a lot of the work for the firm, and they're doing it because they want to make partner. Once you make partner, you get paid a lot, and some of the pressure is off, right? The associates don't get paid as much as the partners, but you're willing to take that associate's position because that's the only way to finally get to be rewarded as a partner. You know, maybe there's the special parking space or the extra large office or a plaque on the wall or a fancy title or some other reward that you only get after you've been with the firm for a certain period of time. All of these things, you know, in isolation, you might think they're ineffective, right? You know, well, this guy with the big office, he's not any more productive than the guy with the little office. Yeah, but the promise of getting the big office, if you're good, gives the guy in the little office an incentive to work hard. And these things may be in the interest of the firm overall. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about incentives. You know, other forms of incentives, you know, bonus pay, giving a worker stock options or something like that. This is a very broad area, and there's a lot of research and a lot of consulting work that's designed to help firms figure out, you know, what the bonus rate should be and whether they should pay options or so forth. I'm just going to give you a kind of a high-level sketch of this literature because the basic ideas are pretty easy to convey. Also, I'm hoping that we'll have a little bit more time than we usually have for questions in today's session because, you know, this is our last formal meeting together. And you may have questions not only about what we're discussing today, but things that we discussed earlier in the course. And I want to have sort of a no-holds-barred kind of Q&A. So what are some of the basic issues in designing compensation schemes? you know, one of the most basic issues is whether firms should use a so-called piece rate or whether they should use a time rate, right? A piece rate means payment per piece produced or, you know, per unit of output. So, again, in a factory, if you got paid, you know, factory that's making coffee cups, if you get the worker gets paid 10 cents for every coffee cup that is produced, that would be an example of paying per piece. It could also be the piece rate could be in revenue terms or dollar terms. Rather than you know, physical unit terms, right? So people in sales who work on commission, right? Your earnings are, you know, you get 5% of the revenues that you bring in from sales. That's also a kind of piece rate, meaning you're getting how much you get paid depends on how much you produce, as opposed to a compensation scheme where you get paid according to the amount of time you put in, right? A so-called time rate is where you get paid $10 per hour, or $100,000 per year, or so many dollars per month, or whatever. So with a time rate, right, your compensation is not directly tied to your productivity. I mean, it's indirectly tied in the sense that, well, if you're not productive, you're not going to get that job in the first place, and if you're unproductive, you're probably going to get fired, and so forth. But, you know, pay period by pay period, your compensation is determined by the amount of time you put in rather than the amount of stuff that came out, right? So a piece rate ties compensation to output or outcomes. A time rate ties compensation to inputs rather than outputs. You know, there are a lot of different, obviously there are a lot of jobs that use piece rate compensation schemes. A lot that use time rate compensation schemes. And, you know, it's not obvious that one is necessarily better than the other. There are trade-offs, right? I mean, in sales, it seems like a good idea to use some kind of piece rate scheme to compensate salespeople according to how much they sell. But, you know, think of a car company, a car dealership like CarMax. Those of you in the U.S. may be familiar with CarMax. This is a car dealership where they sell multiple makes of cars, new and used, and there is no haggling, right? There's no arguing, no negotiating between the salesperson and the customer. There's a sticker price on the car, and you pay that price. You know, no wheeling and dealing. Now, so in fact, places like CarMax, they even advertise as part of their advertising, our salespeople don't work on commission. You know, why would that be a selling point for the firm? Well, because in many cultures, buying a used car in particular, is not a pleasant experience, because some people don't like to haggle, they don't like to negotiate, they don't like the pushy salesman. There's a particular place where I get my car serviced, and I won't name the place or even the brand of car, but you know, their salespeople are paid by commission, and one of the reasons I know this is because anytime I take my car in to be serviced, or I just drop by to pick up my wife who is having her car serviced, you know, as soon as I pull into the parking lot, there's a swarm of salespeople rushing up to approach me and ask me how I'm doing and tell me how nice I look and see if I'm interested in some of the new models that have just come in, right? And that can actually be pretty unpleasant. So if customers prefer an environment where the salespeople are not pushy, then it may be a competitive advantage for the firm not to use sales commissions, but to pay all the salespeople a flat rate. Now, again, the problem there is that maybe the workers will be lazy. Maybe they won't try so hard to sell. So, you know, from the employer's point of view, you got to balance these two things out, right? The advantages of making your workers really want to sell with the disadvantages of possibly alienating your customers. Another important issue has to do with the quality of the output, right? I mean, if the quality of what's produced, the good or service produced, you know, sort of varies and it depends on the employee's effort, then, you know, paying a piece rate may encourage the workers to produce a lot very fast, but at the expense of quality. And so maybe time rates assure or give you, you know, you're more likely to get a higher quality. I used to ask my university students exam question something like, why do you think that apple pickers are typically paid according to weight, the number of apples picked, but airplane safety inspectors are usually not paid per plane inspected? Think about it. That's an easy one, okay? So piece rates have advantages, but they have drawbacks as well, such as making customers unhappy, shirking on quality. We also might want to think about potential trade-offs between extrinsic and intrinsic rewards, right? So you know, a sales commission, a 5% commission on sales, that's very extrinsic, meaning quantitative and measurable. The reward is extra cash in your pocket. But there may be intrinsic rewards that can be used to motivate workers as well. The more you sell, you know, that the more pleasant the boss becomes, right? So if you don't sell a lot, the boss nags you and gets on your case and growls at you, and that's unpleasant. And so if you produce higher quality or higher quantity, you get a pleasant work environment. There may simply be, of course, the you know, intrinsic satisfaction that we all have from a job well done. That may be part of the reward as well. It may be very internally focused. And again, there may be trade-offs between the use of extrinsic and intrinsic rewards as well. Now, economists who have studied compensation policies have worked a lot with one specific kind of formal model of worker motivation, and it's called the principal agent model. The terms principal and agent come from the legal literature, right? There's legal notion of a principal. And by the way, I noticed on my slide I've committed the cardinal freshman level mistake of misspelling the word principal. It should be principal, a P-A-L, not principal, P-L-E, right? So the principal is a person in the firm, right? Legally, a principal is the sort of initiator of some project. An agent is the person who executes the project. So the principal, P-A-L, PAL, principal agent problem, refers to the potential conflict of interest between somebody, an employer, let's say, who wants coffee cups produced, and a worker who has to produce those coffee cups, an agent. So the idea is the principal You know, the principal wants the coffee cups produced, but the principal cannot produce all the coffee cups himself or herself because he or she lacks the time or the expertise, or there are other things that he or she is better suited to doing. And so the principal delegates delegates to somebody else, a delegate or an agent, the responsibility for producing the coffee cups. And, you know, we all use agents in many of our daily transactions. In the old days, when you went on a trip, we would often use a travel agent, right? So I, as the principal, would contract with an agent to find me the best fare and to book my flights and to get my rental car arranged and so forth. I mean, now we typically do that on our own, thanks to the internet. But when you buy a house, you probably use an agent. You probably use a real estate agent, or if you're selling a house, it's a very complex transaction. It's difficult for most people to do it on their own without help. You know, a famous actor will have an agent to negotiate with the movie studio and so forth, right? A sports, you know, LeBron James has an agent who signs his contract. If I hire a lawyer to, you know, to help me with some documents or to get me out of a speeding ticket or whatever, that lawyer is an agent operating on my behalf as a principal. You know, agency relationships can be tremendously valuable because not everyone in his role as a principal has the capability of doing everything that an agent does. But there is a potential conflict of interest between principal and agent, right? And while I tell you this story, I'm going to correct the typo on my slide because it's just bugging me so much. So I'll continue to talk about the principal-agent problem as I'm correcting my slide. Right? So the advantage to the principal of using an agent, there we go, is that the principal gets the benefits of the agent's expertise and knowledge. Ah, much better. Okay. I just ain't a little about it, I'm sorry. The principal gets the benefit of the agent's services, but there's a danger that the agent may not do exactly what the principal wants. I mean, you know, if I hire a real estate agent to show me houses that I could potentially buy and then to negotiate with the seller and to make sure that the house passes inspection and that all of the legal issues are taken care of, I mean, that's hard work. And my agent, my real estate agent, may not put in quite as much effort as I would if I were doing it myself, right? Because I'm the one who's paying for it, and I'm the one living in the house. My agent, you know, may be a nice person, maybe a friend, maybe a trained professional who's trying to do his best or her best for the principal, but just doesn't have the same motivation. They're working with many clients, and this is just something they do for a living, and they may not be willing to put in quite as much effort, do quite as much background research, negotiate, you know, be quite as tough in the negotiations as I would as the buyer, okay? Again, this is not saying that agents are lazy or agents are bad people, just that the agent's incentives are not as strong as the principal's by definition of the problem, right? Because the principal is the one who wants it done. The agent is just a hired hand who's working on the principal's behalf. Now, you might say, oh, well, you know, this is an easy problem to solve. You just pay the agent on commission. You know, like a real estate agent gets paid a commission based on the sales price. LeBron James's agent gets paid according, you know, some percentage of the contract that he negotiates for LeBron James. Even a factory worker, right, with some kind of incentive scheme gets paid according to how well they do the job. So if I'm a principal who owns a styrofoam cup factory and I pay an agent to make the cups for me, I can simply pay that agent a piece rate or cash bonuses based on revenues, or I can pay stock options to try to align the interests of the agent with those of the principal. However, that does not perfectly solve the principal-agent problem. Why? Because, you know, how many cups can my cup worker actually produce per day? Well, that depends on how hard the worker works, right? It depends on the worker's effort. It depends on the if they're hardworking and if they work carefully and so forth. But it may also depend on factors outside the agent's control. The quality of the machines that are used to make cups. And, you know, if I'm compensating this worker based on revenues, it also depends on the demand for cups in the market and the marketing strategy of the firm and, you know, consumers' incomes and maybe, you know, business cycle factors or other things that are beyond the agent's control. It's even easier to see that, you know, in the real estate case, right? I mean, I have friends who are real estate agents, and how much they get paid, I mean, it does depend on whether they're good agents, how hard they work and how personable they are and how well they listen to the client and so forth. But a lot also depends on macroeconomic factors, real estate market conditions. You know, maybe some sellers are just really not cooperative and you can't negotiate a good deal for your buyer. There are a lot of things that affect the outcome in a principal-agent relationship other than the quality of the effort put forth by the worker. So if you try to motivate the agent by compensating the agent based on the output of the relationship, you know, that helps. That helps to align the agent's interests with those of the principal, but it doesn't totally solve the problem because the agent knows that he or she might work as hard as possible to get the principal what the principal wants, and it still might not work. You know, some days you get the bear and some days the bear gets you. Knowing that the amount you get paid is not completely within your control because output or revenues are not completely within your control, you're not going to work quite as hard as you would if there were no principal-agent relationship at all, if you were doing everything for yourself. So because some of the risks are outside the agent's control, you know, you might think that, well, you know, if the principal is a big company or the principal is a wealthy person with a diversified portfolio, it might be more efficient for the principal to pay the agent more of a flat rate, you know, more of a time rate rather than a piece rate, so the agent doesn't bear all the risk of these fluctuations in output that are beyond the agent's control. But, again, paying a piece rate, that provides some insurance for the agent, but it also means the agent is not as strongly motivated to work hard. So the idea is there's a basic trade-off here, right? The extent to which you give the agent strong performance incentives, that provides motivation, but it also makes the job risky, and some agents may not want the job. And the extent to which you provide flat pay, more base pay, right? That gives the agent some insurance. It means the agent bears less risk, and that makes agents happy and may allow you to attract better agents to the job. But the agents aren't as strongly motivated as they were before. You know, how you manage that trade-off as an employer depends on the specific context of the problem, right? There's no perfect incentive scheme to mitigate principal-agent problems. There are just trade-offs between one type of compensation scheme and another, right? Some you know, sort of extensions to think about, right? One problem in dealing with principal-agent relationships is benchmarking, right? You know, if you want to reward an agent for good performance, you may not know exactly what good performance is, right? I mean, how many cups can I reasonably expect to come off the assembly line if I want to give my agent a bonus for producing, you know, an extraordinarily large number of cups or high-quality cups? I need some idea of how many cups somebody should be able to produce. And, you know, in a factory setting, you might think about, you know, these old-fashioned time and motion studies, other kinds of benchmarking exercises, but those may not be very effective in the services sector and many other kinds of contexts. So what we often do, what firms often do, is they may benchmark according to the performance of rival workers or rival firms. Sometimes past performance can be used to create a benchmark. There's a problem with using past performance as a benchmark. Namely, you get a kind of ratchet effect, And those of you who have studied Bob Higgs's great work in the history of regulation in the American economy know what Higgs means by the ratchet effect, right? That regulation, government intervention only goes one way. We always get more of it during a so-called crisis period, but it doesn't go back when the crisis period is over. Likewise, if you let the employee's past performance be the benchmark for getting future rewards, that has some motivational problems associated with it, right? If I'm in sales, if I have a really great 2013, and then the firm sets my 2013 sales as my benchmark for 2014, well then to get a bonus every year, I've got to exceed last year's performance. If I happen to have a down year, my benchmark is not likely to be moved down. It's going to stay what it was the last time I had a good year, right? And so I may be nervous about having one really good year because that sets unrealistic expectations for the future. And so I might sandbag it a little bit because I want to perform well, but not too well, because then if I just happen to perform really well one time, the employer will be disappointed when I don't hit that benchmark the last time. Something else that we might do to try to have more precise measurements of the marginal impact of an employee's actions on output is to try to use multiple measures of performance, right? Not just cups per hour, but cups per hour plus, how often the machines break down, and the average quality of the cups, how many times, we have to recall cups and so forth. Excuse me. CEOs are typically paid base pay, but also bonuses based on a number of different factors. The bonus might be tied to stock price, but also to market position, market share, might also be tied to customer satisfaction ratings and other things, right? The idea is, factors that are beyond the agent's control are likely to affect some measures of performance, but not all of them at the same time. Right, so if the if the stock market goes down, that's not the CEO's fault. That may affect the stock price of the firm. So penalizing the CEO with less stock-based compensation is sort of hurting the CEO for something that is not the CEO's fault, namely a general decline in stock prices. But if the compensation formula also includes a bonus for market position or market share, a bonus based on customer satisfaction ratings, those things are not likely to be affected by a decrease in the stock price. So a compensation plan that includes multiple measures of performance does not unfairly reward or penalize the agent for things that are outside the agent's control. And that's why we do tend to see firms using multiple measures of performance where multiple measures are available. We might also want to evaluate performance relative to other firms or relative to other employees rather than by some absolute standard, right? So if we give a bonus for the employee of the month, like a parking space for the employee of the month, that's the best employee that month. So to get that bonus, if you're in sales, for example, to get that bonus, you have to sell more than what everybody else sold. Now, the advantage of that sort of standard, as opposed to giving people a bonus for selling X dollars worth of merchandise, is that if the market's down, if the product is not so good, if customers are just not willing to buy that week, that doesn't penalize the salesperson for something that's outside the salesperson's control. Industry-level factors, macroeconomic factors, would presumably affect all salespeople equally. So as long as you're better than the other salespeople in the organization, you get the bonus, even if your overall sales are down relative to some absolute standard. Now, of course, that kind of sort of tournament model can have drawbacks as well, right? It's just like winning a race, right? To win the race, you can either win it by being faster than everybody else or by sabotaging your competitors somehow, trying to trip up the guy in the lane next to you. So using a employee of the month scheme, a relative performance evaluation scheme within the firm, might make it more difficult to get workers to work together They might not cooperate with each other because everybody wants to do better than the other employees. Another problem arises when employees are asked to perform multiple tasks, right? So you're asking, you know, the guy who makes the styrofoam cups to produce a lot of cups and take care of the machines and greet customers when they come into the shop. That's three different tasks. If you compensate that worker only according to quantifiable, measurable sorts of things, then the worker's going to, you know, I mean, the number of cups that comes off the assembly line, that's measurable. How kindly you treat customers when they walk in the store may not be. So if you use quantitative performance measures, that worker is likely to focus, you know, most of his attention on making cups. And if somebody comes into the store, they're not going to get much attention. They're going to get short shrift because time you spend chatting with this person who comes into the store is, you know, less time available for making cups. So firms may prefer not to use quantitative piece rate kind of incentive schemes, but rather to give bonuses, but to give them on more subjective kind of qualitative grounds. Maybe there's a quarterly evaluation by a supervisor that's qualitative and subjective. You know, you get the bonus if the supervisor thinks that you're doing a good job overall. Maybe there isn't a number attached to it, attached to your performance, just an overall feeling on the part of you of the supervisor that you're doing a good job. Now, the advantage of using subjective evaluation criteria is that they can work well in a multitasking environment, right? So the worker is not, you know, incentives are not distorted to focus only on the tasks that are highly measurable, but they may motivate the employee to spend time equally on, you know, many tasks, to balance effort across tasks. But there are a number of drawbacks, right? I mean, the evaluation may be biased on the part of the supervisor. Supervisors cannot easily commit to specific targets if everything is qualitative and subjective rather than quantitative and objective. So again, all we can do here is identify some useful trade-offs associated with using one sort of scheme or another. Let me talk a little bit about executive comp. I think the article by Kaplan, does a good job of sort of evaluating this specific problem in the context of CEO pay. I think the Kaplan article is very straightforward, so I won't spend time talking about it here. I'll note that some of the same points that were made by Kaplan were made in a New York Times article that appeared just a couple of days ago, February the 15th, and by Greg Mankiw, professor at Harvard. And Mankiw explains very nicely, I think, how, you know, yes, executives are paid a lot, but in most cases, the pay of an executive can be related to the marginal revenue product of that executive. And what one thing that's noteworthy about this column is it called forth a typically nasty and uninformed response by Paul Krugman, who the same day wrote a little thing denouncing Mankiw without actually addressing any of Mankiw's points and without actually mentioning any facts whatsoever about how pay is determined. So, okay. So to conclude, you know, the sort of ultimate determinant of wages is marginal productivity. As Mises pointed out, in the long run, you know, government intervention in the labor market, you know, fixing, mandating wages or mandating benefit packages and so forth, you know, pressure by labor unions to increase wages above their marginal revenue products cannot raise real wages, right? That cannot improve the material living standards of workers. The way, you know, the reason that we all are so much better off today than our, you know, forebears were, the reason we get paid more in real terms than people did 100 years ago is because we're so much more productive, because we have so much more capital and better technology that allows our labor to be more productive. So if we're concerned about the well-being of wage earners, the best thing that we can do is allow the market economy to flourish and allow innovation and entrepreneurship and capital investment to increase marginal productivity. However, you know, in the short run and in proximate cases, wage contracts can be complicated, right? And they vary according to the circumstances. The theory of marginal productivity does not mean that, you know, at every single moment, I'm getting paid in cash exactly what that moment of my labor has contributed to the marginal revenue of my employer, appropriately discounted. No, I mean, pay can vary moment by moment according to different incentive criteria. Some of my pay may be non-monetary. Some of it may be deferred rather than received in this moment. Some of it may be intangible, right? And so if we look at particular labor markets, we want to understand the complexities of different kinds of pay. We need to take all of these things into consideration. There are no one-size-fits-all solutions. What sort of, you know, what kind of arrangement works best depends on the circumstances. Trade-offs matter. Employers and employees are constantly working to sort of figure this out. Okay, so that's the end of our course, right? My claims at the beginning and my claims to you now are that Austrian economics is useful for management. It's different from neoclassical economics, you know, in its causal realist approach, its emphasis on resource heterogeneity, how it treats the consumer and consumer demand being the ultimate driver, and the strong role that it gives to the entrepreneur. Some of you have asked me during the course about, you know, how I can help, or how the principles in this course can help with quantitative analysis, with forecasting, and so on. And the answer is, you know, the analysis that we've done is primarily qualitative, right? Not quantitative. Quantitative analysis is an aspect of entrepreneurship, not scientific theory, right? That's the part of management that's an art rather than a science. But I think having a good knowledge of the basic principles that we've discussed in this course can be a solid foundation for doing better, you know, quantitative analysis, better forecasting, exercising entrepreneurial judgment to try to anticipate the future, and so forth. And that's it. That is all, as they used to say. That's all, folks, as Bugs Bunny used to say. So we've got a lot of good discussion in the chat room. And I'm not going to be able to address all of your questions, but let me see if I can touch on a few. And by the way, feel free to jump in with questions that are not specific to today's topic, but that, you know, apply to anything that we've covered throughout the course. Okay, yes, there's a question from Marek about asking me to clarify what I mean by non-monetary compensation. Merrick says, you're not suggesting that the garbage collector gets paid more than their MRP, correct? Why the need for a separate treatment? No, Merrick, all I'm saying is the MRP, the garbage collector's pay is exactly equal to his MRP, just like his discounted MRP, just like any other worker. What I'm saying is the form in which the garbage collector is paid is more cash and less, you know, pleasantry, less of an enjoyable environment, right? It's easier to see the other way around. You know, if I were hired to load boxes onto a truck and all of the other people working around me were beautiful Sports Illustrated bikini models. Who's that one who's always on the cover? Kate Upton. If my coworker is Kate Upton in a bikini, right, I might accept less cash than I would if my coworker were, you know, the typical guy who loads boxes onto a truck. Okay? So it's not that in both cases my pay is equal to my MRP. My marginal productivity is the same, but in the one case with a smelly, you know, fat guy next to me, my pay is mostly cash. With Kate Upton next to me, my pay is less cash plus some just happiness associated with being in that environment, right? So the garbage collector is getting all cash, right? The guy who loads boxes into a truck is getting less cash plus some satisfaction from not collecting garbage. Okay, so the point is that it's not that compensation doesn't equal MRP. It's that compensation has multiple attributes, right? Pay plus the quality of the work environment. Okay. So, question from Bruce: the farther away the firm's compensation strategy is from, I guess, you know, what's sort of optimal in the market, the more likely there will be errors that will affect the viability of the firm. Absolutely. How does an entrepreneur avoid, you know, getting it wrong? Look, I mean, if I knew that, I mean, I'd be a the world's most successful entrepreneur myself, right? I mean, one way to sort of turn the question around is, you know, the better the entrepreneur at getting this right, the more successful the firm will be. Now, in a highly volatile environment with a lot of uncertainty, when the firm is introducing new products and services for which we have little information about future receipts, you know, it's going to be much harder to get this right. And those entrepreneurs will make more errors on average. I mean, part of the sort of, you know, outcome of market competition, the process of selecting skilled entrepreneurs over less skilled entrepreneurs, has to do with, you know, the entrepreneur's ability to motivate his or her employees. Right? Being a successful entrepreneur in a multi-person organization is not just about, you know, getting the right color for the product. It's not just about having the right marketing strategy. It's about how to find the right workers and how to motivate those workers. And that can be very difficult in a complex environment. So, you know, my advice to the entrepreneur is to think through the principles that we've outlined tonight, right? What, you know, what is the best way to get the right performance out of these employees? If it's mostly, you know, building something, and you can easily measure the quality of what the worker has produced, you know, then a piece rate scheme makes sense. If you're operating a farm and you're hiring fruit pickers, then probably you want to pay them by weight. If you're in a different kind of environment where output is hard to measure, where marginal productivity is hard to measure, where quality is highly variable, then maybe paying workers according to hours worked or paying them on a salaried basis is the right way to go. Now, when we say that, you know, in a case like that, you know, it's still true that the amount that the employee gets paid on average over time is roughly equal to his discounted marginal revenue product. That doesn't mean that the entrepreneur is going to be able to get this exactly right moment by moment, right? It just means that it will be, you know, there's sort of pressure in the market for factors of production to be traded at prices roughly equal to their marginal revenue products. But this can be very difficult, and that's why not you know, that's why some entrepreneurs are more successful than others. yeah, so let me say a couple words about bureaucracy. I mean, remember that as we know from our readings, what Mises means by bureaucracy is not just a firm with a lot of rules and standard procedures, right? He means a bureaucracy is a firm that operates in a particular environment, meaning a firm that produces goods and services that are not bought and sold on markets. So that, you know, tying compensation to output is very difficult to do because you don't have measurable outputs because you don't buy and sell your stuff in the market. You know, it could be a nonprofit, it could be a university, it could be a government agency, right? Because it's very difficult to tie pay to performance, you're not likely to give workers much latitude, right? It's very difficult to incentivize workers with a bonus scheme. You know, again, you wouldn't want to have a police force where the police are paid on a per arrest basis, right? Therefore, according to Mises, such firms are will be less likely to give their workers latitude. And there will be more of an emphasis on following standardized rules and procedures, again, as a consequence of the fact that output is difficult to measure. So, you know, again, you're not likely to see a lot of piece rate schemes in that kind of environment. You're more likely to see an emphasis on time rates. And again, you won't see a lot of delegation, as we talked about last week. You'll see much more emphasis on, you know, following sort of standardized routines. That doesn't mean that that's always an ineffective way of managing, even for for-profit firms. But again, it may be that trying to tie pay to output leads to problems with quality. It leads to problems of measurement, makes customers unhappy. So, you know, so-called bureaucratic compensation schemes may be perfectly effective for a for-profit firm, you know, again, if the environment is right, depending on the characteristics of the product, depending on the characteristics of consumers, and so forth. Okay. Let's see. Another question, since value is subjective and the market reflects this, wouldn't subjective performance evaluation be the best? That's a good question, but I think it's a little bit confusing, right? These are two different uses of the word subjective, or two different applications of the concept of subjective value, right? When Austrians talk about value being subjective, they mean that, you know, the willingness of a customer to pay for one styrofoam cup cannot be objectively ascertained by the chemical properties of the cup or the amount of labor that went into making the cup and so forth. You know, it's purely in the mind of the consumer. You know, what we mean by subjective evaluation schemes is that the principal evaluating an agent, the employer evaluating an employee, does not try to measure the employee's performance on some quantitative numerical grounds, right? So you get paid 10 cents for every cup provided, every cup produced, or you get a bonus if you produce 10,000 cups. That is an objective scheme, a quantifiable scheme. The idea that, well, you know, you get a bonus if the supervisor likes you, if the supervisor gives you a 5 on a 5-point scale instead of a 3. I mean, you know, that's also subjective, but there is, you know, that doesn't follow from what Austrians mean by the subjective theory of value, right? I mean, no matter what you believe about value theory, how consumers evaluate final products, you know, you might think that the firm ought to use objective performance measures, right? So it's a different, there's no direct tie between the Austrian notion of subjectivism more generally, and what I mean in this context by subjective evaluation schemes. I simply mean evaluation schemes that rely on the good judgment of the evaluator rather than just some kind of formula, right? But as a lot of you know, if you work in this area, I mean, there are a lot of complicated formulas that maybe are good. You know, there's so-called 360-degree evaluation schemes. There's, you know, different sort of measure peer kind of metrics that can be used to evaluate, and those are all, to a different extent, those are all objective in the sense that they use feedback and numbers that can be aggregated into some kind of a formula, but they're not just a simple piece rate scheme, you know, that might give you problems on the quality side. Remember also that most workers have kind of a mixed set of compensation. I mean, compensation schemes can be joined together. I mean, most people get some salary and some bonus, right? Most salespeople get some base pay plus commission. Some get 100% commission. Some get only base pay and no commission. But it's more common to have a mix of, you know, piece rate pay and time rate pay and piece rate pay. They're not mutually exclusive, in other words. So you might decide that you want kind of the best of both worlds. You want to give your employees some, you know, guaranteed minimum pay as long as they perform satisfactorily enough to keep the jobs. But then you want to give them some additional bonus pay for hitting certain milestones or based on output or based on stock price or whatever. You know, by the way, there are other reasons why firms might choose one kind of compensation method over another. They're not strictly determined by, you know, organizational design issues. I mean, a lot of tech startups, for example, pay their employees in stock options because they don't have any cash flows, right? So my claim today has not been that these different compensation schemes, you know, are only relevant to sort of how you motivate your employees. I mean, there may be other reasons, reasons associated with market position, reasons associated with, you know, financial constraints that lead a firm to choose sort of one or the other. But, you know, the key is to evaluate these different means of paying, different HRM practices, and evaluate their costs and benefits. I think the readings for this week do a good job of doing that. The article on HRM, sort of a, you know, bird's eye view of different issues that come up related to compensation policy. Again, hoping to get you to see that all feasible policies have some benefits and some costs. Okay, well, it is time to sign off. I hope you guys have enjoyed tonight's discussion, and I hope that you've enjoyed all six of our video meetings. Again, the course is not over. In a few days, those of you who want to take the exam will have the opportunity to do so. But the course will remain live on Moodle. The opportunity to ask questions on the discussion forums, those will still be going for the next several weeks. So please, if you haven't done all the readings, as you begin to catch up, as you look over old lectures again, old videos again, let's keep the discussion going. Ask questions, pose challenges. We all have access to those discussion forums, and let's continue to learn from each other over the next several weeks. Please drop me an email at any time. You can email me at pkline@mises.org. I'm happy to take your questions at any time on any aspect of this course or really on anything. So keep in touch and look forward to hanging out with you guys again.